Public Safety Finance Division will come to order. Members will be hearing from the rest of the court budget presentation. Time permitting, we will get through civil legal services budget as well as the public defender's budget. If we don't, we will come back Tuesday and finish up those budgets. That's what I want to say. We are going to adjourn about 5 minutes earlier than at 5 to 10. We have the DFL members anyway have the public Dennis. Mr. Verdon, we have a caucus at 10 o'clock that we're supposed to be there sharply. So we will be adjourning at 5 to 10. So. Okay, Sue DeSalle, welcome back to the committee, and I am trying to you where we left off here yesterday or on Tuesday. You want to just? I know we jumped around a little bit.
Sheriff, we might start on slide 12.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the division, as you will recall, yesterday we sort of ended up talking about the impact of the budget cut. We indicated that, of course, was our number one priority to eliminate that budget cut. We did talk about that in the fall before the economic meltdown that we have now seen. We did put in some positive requests for this biennium, and they are the ones that are shown here. There are four of them. The first change request that we have, it was called Maintain Core Justice Operations, is really to provide what we have projected would be the necessary funding to just keep the employees that we have right now, which you recall yesterday we talked about we're operating 9% short now. And this change request is comprised of two components. The first is called unavoidable compensation obligations. This is just for our current employees. Assuming there is no wage increase, no steps, no across the board, just for our current employees, we're going to have to pay about $9.3 million for unavoidable costs. This includes health insurance, projected at 6% per year. It includes statutorily mandated employer contributions, increases employer contributions to pension funds. And it includes the annualization of our FY09 union contracts and compensation plans. So even if there is a wage freeze that is achieved, this would be funding that we would have to pay. And as I indicated earlier, this approximately $3 million, if we do not get new funding for that, that translates into about 126 positions that would have to be laid off. The second component of this is what we've had projected in the fall for wage increases, and that was based on what was happening in the metro area around that time. Steps plus about a 3% across the board. So again, as I say, if the executive branch negotiates with its unions and it sets the pattern for the judiciary, if the executive branch can achieve a wage freeze, that would determine whether this funding would be needed.
Are there any questions at this point? Please continue.
Mr. Chair, members, then the second change request is for mandated services, and this request the governor has recommended funding. As you know, we have put in place in recent years a lot of time and effort to restructure these programs. We've put in statewide oversight, management oversight, uniform pay rates and consistent practices, and performance measures and the like, but the costs for these areas are continuing to grow. You might recall that last biennium, this last session, we asked for a supplemental request for $1.9 million for mandated services, but did not achieve it. So we are here asking for funds for these services over which we have no control for the demand, and we have to pay them. Let me talk about each one of the areas in turn. For guardians ad litem, what we're experiencing is about a 12% growth over the last 2 years in appointments, and you know that we are mandated by state and federal law to appoint a guardian ad litem in every case where abuse or neglect is alleged. We also are seeing an increase in the complexity of those abuse and neglect cases. These are growing more complex as the social safety net is triaging, forced to triage, and now what we're seeing is that really only the neediest and the most high-risk families are actually getting into the court system, and they have multiple challenges, complexities, and needs. And so the average hours that our guardians ad litem are spending on these cases is increasing, and in the last 2 years it has increased from 55 to 64 hours. So based on the increased cost, average cost, in over the last 3 years of about 8.5%, we are projecting that increase in cost into the next biennium and are requesting that funding. Interpreters. You can see from this graph that immigration is continuing to grow at a very steep rate in Minnesota. The number of people that were granted legal permanent residence in Minnesota grew from about 15,500 to a little over 18,000 between 2005 and 2006, and that's the last year for which we have these figures. And that was an 18% increase just in 1 year. So all that growth means increased need for interpreters in our courts. Last year we had interpreters in 81 languages. They're used on average 152 proceedings each day in the courts. All of you know that this need is not limited in the metro area, it is all over the state. And in the last 3 years, the number of interpreter court events increased from by 16%. So based on an average growth, we're asking for an increase of about 5% per year into this next biennium.
Mr. Shaw, Representative Ward has a question.
I'm sorry.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, I've been in close contact with the Guardian Ad Litem program out of the 9th District in my area. I received a number of concerns regarding that program, so I've met a couple times with both the Guardian staff and the Guardians and constituents and such. And I've grown to understand and appreciate the program from both sides. Does it appear that the program was in disarray for a while, and it's trying to correct a lot of the things that were a problematic situation to constituents. Help me with the increased request. Are you going to still continue to address, like, for example, how do I even make a complaint if I'm a constituent, if I'm a service client? How do I make a complaint? When does it get processed? There's a large number of concerns, and I know other legislators have heard some of those same concerns. For the new revenue, are you going to continue to work on moving the program forward? I'd like to hear something about that.
Mr. Shaw.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, thanks for the question. This is one of the toughest areas that we deal with. I mean, there's nothing that's more emotional than the allegation of abuse and neglect and the loss of children permanently. I mean, some people have said that's akin to Minnesota's capital punishment. So there are very real emotions. There's a lot of acrimony in these cases. I just have to tell you that. And there are no winners. There are just a lot of that. When these programs were funded at the county level until about 2001, there was disparity. There were no standards for the training of guardians, their background. There were no background checks of guardians. When we took it over, we have restructured it entirely, moving from 56 programs that were disparate. They had pay from volunteers to $65 an hour. We had just no understanding of all of this. And on top of it, while we have a state and federal mandate for the last 25 years that there'd be the guardian ad litem appointed in each of these cases, we found that only 60% of the cases had guardians ad litem appointed. So we were failing in that. So we have spent an enormous amount of time and effort in this last number of years to restructure that program entirely, to put in place the kinds of background checks, training, standards, and supervision that is needed. And I can tell you, I can assure you, this is part of the Chief Justice Black's Children's Justice Initiative. It was the very first thing that she started to do, is to clean up this. And we have come a long, long way. There is a complaint mechanism for this, and it goes to the guardian ad litem manager, and there is that opportunity, as well as to go to the judge themselves, the presiding judge. So we do have that mechanism. We are using that, and do spend a good bit of time on and dealing with those complaints. But I would say that I think that there, early on, until we dealt with some of the training and the individuals who actually are performing as guardians, dealt with background checks, there were issues. I agree, and we believe that we have gone a long, long way toward improving that tremendously.
Thank you. I won't take a lot more time, but I have seen that and understand that and read about it, and I appreciate it. Let me just give you a quick couple of feedback things. The complaint process is as you indicated, is available, but on the web, it's difficult to find and difficult to process. Also, if I want to call a person or a contact for the guardian ad litem program, as I look in the phone book, there's no listing of guardian ad litem. Even something as simple as listing the guardian ad litem program in the phone book would help in communication and would help people feel that they're listened to significantly, and I can't believe that would be a significant financial impact. But those things are so important, as you mentioned, for the whole emotional involvement here of folks who are involved in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ward, and we will act on that.
Representative Liebling had a question before you proceed.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. O'Sal, talking about interpreters, the court now has the payables list that we've all been talking about. I'd like to know whether this, your projection, your request on the interpreter side takes into account that now a lot of people are not going to be actually appearing in court. I mean, that obviously has an impact on need for public defender time, but I assume it also has an impact on interpreters, and I'm just guessing that lots and lots of those people who are now not going to have to make an appearance are actually the population that would have needed an interpreter. Can you discuss that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, this number does not include that. The expanded payable list was not approved until December by the Judicial Council. Of course, this budget was put in October, so it does not include that. I think it would have a marginal impact, because a lot, as we understand now, a lot of the individuals who come into court on these kinds of matters, these are, you know, basically driving regulations, smaller matters. They're set on for arraignment, but actually they meet with the assistant county attorney or prosecutor, city attorney, and most of them are working out the deals there. So I'm not sure that it would have a significant impact, but it may.
Representative
Liebling. Well, Mr. Sal, thank you, Mr. Chair. If they're working out a deal, presumably they're doing it with an interpreter. now. If they need an interpreter, they surely needed one to work out a deal. And I guess I don't have a very good sense of how many cases are going to be taken out of that stream by the payables list and what the impact of that is going to be. And I think that, you know, since we're talking about these smaller cases, which according to your pie charts, are probably a large portion of the cases this court is handling, I guess I'd like to get a better handle on that. And then I think, you know, given that we're trying to look at every nickel here, I think we probably need to know what the impact of that is going to be on these other services.
Mr.
Chair and Representative Liebling, I agree, and perhaps we could do some estimate of that. We aren't quite sure what the impact is going to be on that expandable payable list, but we certainly can take a look at that and get back to you. One thing I would just mention is that the vast majority of all those cases that are listed as the lower level cases actually do pay, and so they never come into the court. But we can take a look, see what we can do in terms of estimating this impact that you're speaking about.
Representative Orland, then Bigham, and then we should really...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that same line of questioning as Representative Liebling, I had one quick question. And that the question that I have is, does that interpreter payable list necessarily going to make as much difference as one thinks it is? Because if they're payables and you need an interpreter, are they going to understand the payable system any more than they're going to understand the court system?
Mr. Saw.
Mr. Chair and Representative Olin, they get a ticket that's in English, and I'm not quite sure how that works, but we continue to have a lot of people that are sending in their checks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, please let me know if you've already addressed this, and I do apologize for being late. I had another bill to present, another committee. How does... one get evaluated, or does a person get evaluated if they need an interpreter? Is there some sort of process, or is it just a simple request and it's granted?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, it really is the individual themselves who says that they cannot understand, and then there is a voir dire process where the judge does a voir dire dealing with the interpreter issue. But it really is the individual that determines it. We do not screen out and say, you know what, I think you can really understand. We don't do that. If there is it seems to be a need that we can't communicate with the individual, and they don't seem to be understanding, then an interpreter is used.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, and I guess if a judge or a prosecutor or even a defense attorney thought that that wasn't the case, that this person was able to communicate, what is the process then? Is there like, you know, if we're a public defender, if somebody, public defender that has to then report that the client that they have has a job or received additional income, but is there any sort of process where one of those three individuals representing the system could then raise a concern or raise it to the court's attention?
I'm sure they could. Typically, when there's an in-custody situation, we find out from the jail in advance that an individual needs an interpreter, and so they're there at the time rather than rescheduling. So it's usually through the system, through the jail, through the public defender, that we understand that there is an interpreter that's needed.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bigham, most people in court don't want an interpreter unless it's necessary, absolutely. And in most cases, it really slows and bogs down the whole process. So if you can do without one, you do. The problem is a person comes in and they can communicate fine, and they're on the tape, or the evidence suggests that they can communicate in English, but the legal terms maybe aren't familiar with them. So people default to interpreter that way. But if it's not needed, I think the safeguard, which is the question you're getting at, is that if there's any way that it's not needed and that the defendant understands all the terms and everything, that everyone will agree that we just don't need one.
Thank you. Mr. Saul, would you continue?
Mr. Chair, then the final area in the mandated services, the psychological services request, you know, as you all know, the this area has been a continuing growing area since 2003 and the change in the Department of Corrections policy dealing with these level 3 sex offenders. In the last 3 years, the costs have increased by over 20%, and most of this cost, of course, is coming from the sexually dangerous and sexual psychopathic personality cases. And those cases in the last 2 years have increased dramatically. So our request is for is based on about a 6.8% average increase in this area. We
please continue. Sure.
Now we're going to just skip to slide 25 as we've gone over that other, and we move to our drug and mental health court change request, and to talk to you a little bit first about the effectiveness of the drug courts. I'm going to call on Judge Robert Rancourt, judge of 10th District, sitting in Chisago County, and he is a drug court judge in the juvenile court there, and is also the co-chair of our drug court initiative advisory committee.
Judge, welcome to the committee. Would you please state your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Robert Rancourt, and I'm a district court judge chambered in Chisago County.
Excuse me.
In the 10th Judicial District.
It's Rancourt?
Rancourt. C-O-U-R-T.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have the honor of presiding over the Chisago County Juvenile Drug Court. I also serve as the current co-chair of the Drug Court Initiative Advisory Workgroup, commonly known as the DCI. DCI is comprised of representatives from the judicial branch, the executive branch, county government, community members, and drug court graduates. The DCI advises the Judicial Council on long-term strategy, accountability, and sustainability of the overall drug court initiative. I'm also on the board of directors of the National Association of Drug Court Professionals, which represents about 19,000 drug court professionals nationwide. I am before you today to discuss the effectiveness of drug courts and the positive impact drug courts have had on juveniles or children, families, veterans, and public safety. Our Supreme Court task force has studied the issue of addicted offenders in the Minnesota courts for over 18 months and came to the conclusion over 2 years ago that without drug courts you would continue to do what does not work. And that simply doesn't make a lot of sense. Studies conducted around the country show that positive cost-benefit ratios typically result for drug court participants who complete programs that adhere to established best practices. Preliminary results in Minnesota are showing us the same results: cost avoided for jail and prison, and individuals returning to crime-free lives as tax-paying citizens. Recidivism is reduced. And while offenders receive intensive supervision while in drug court, most of which dramatically improve public safety. For example, nationwide, 75% of drug court graduates remain arrest-free at least 2 years after leaving the drug court. That is compared to 46% of those on standard probation. The state of Washington found that the average drug court participant produces approximately $6,800 in benefits, which is broken down as $3,800 in avoided criminal justice costs paid directly by taxpayers and $3,000 in estimated avoided costs to victims. And the members should understand, of course, and I know you do, that that's only related to correctional costs. We're not talking about the cost of society as far as public health, further victimization, loss of employment. Those are also residual benefits of an individual that attends a drug court and successfully graduates. Drug courts demonstrate savings for an extended period of time. Over 10 years, the Multnomah County Drug Court in Oregon recognized a savings of over $79 million, resulting in a benefit of $6,744 per drug court participant. Minnesota is a national leader in putting the right people in prison by using community-based alternatives in place of incarceration. And even saying that, as you all know, there's about 9,200 in our correctional facilities in Minnesota as far as inmates are concerned. That's not counting county jails. About 39% of those are deemed nonviolent offenders, primarily in there for alcohol and drug-related offenses. And about 80% of the prison population does have alcohol and drug-related offenses. Drug courts are essential to effectively managing and treating the addicted offender that remains in our communities. In Minnesota, we currently have 37 drug and mental health courts, which are still relatively new but are beginning to demonstrate those same positive outcomes. In January of 2002, there were two drug courts in the state of Minnesota. In January of 2009, there were 37 operational drug courts. As of September 30th, 2008, we had 902 participants in all of our drug courts with a total of 502 graduates since July of 2001. Now, the graduate number is somewhat reduced because we have not considered the Hennepin County Drug Court to begin in 1996. The model was restructured in 2007, so those graduates were not included in that particular number at this time. Of those graduates that entered drug court without a job, 74% left employed or as a full-time student. Six of Minnesota's oldest drug courts over a three-year period have shown that drug court participants, both completed and non-completed, spent on average half as much time incarcerated as the comparison group, resulting in an estimated cost avoidance of $13,146 per person, or a total of $5 million. Drug court participants spent an average of 24 fewer days in jail and 102 fewer days in prison than the comparison group. This translates into an average of $1,749 per person less spent on jail, $11,397 for prison. As you all know, members, it costs about $33,000 per year to house an inmate in our Minnesota correctional facility. On a national average, I think it costs about $65,000 per bid to construct a new prison. Those are big, big numbers. We believe that spending the taxpayers' dollars in a smart way, but with cuts of the magnitude talked about, drug courts would not be spared. Our partners at Public Safety and DHS have recently agreed to renew grants for our DWI and Family Dependency Courts, as well as one of our mental health courts for some portion of the biennium. But we have close to 20 other courts that have no source of funding, and those previously mentioned will need funding in the last half of the biennium. In closing, I was here Tuesday as well, and heard some of the discussions. When you consider the court's budget request, full funding, I believe, should be a priority. I'm sure you hear that from everyone. But I really do believe the court should be a priority. As the courts are an independent branch of government, having a constitutional requirement to provide access to our courts for all of our citizens. You know, being on the front lines on a daily basis when I hear questions of interpreters and guardian litems and what we all do, it's critical. It's very critical. Individuals that come into our court, we feel that they don't have the ability to understand their constitutional rights, that have any question at all about that, need an interpreter. We have a constitutionally mandated duty to do that. And when we start cutting, that's what concerns me as a judge, that we start having an impact on due process. And that's something we have to be very, very careful about. The courts also provide innovative methods that, in fact, provide cost benefits to the state, such as the drug court program. The impact of insufficient funding means an increase in public health costs, an increase in county jail populations, and a delay in getting high-risk individuals through our courts, which creates a public safety risk for all of the citizens of the state. This is supported by a recent comprehensive survey of possible link between crime and the economy conducted by the Police and Executive Research Forum. The survey found that 44% of agencies throughout the country reported spikes in crime linked to the economy. Of those, 35% reported increases in robberies, 32% in burglaries, and 40% in thefts. And members, you all know where those people are going to end up. They're going to end up in the courts, which is going to put more of a demand on our court system than we even currently have. So I firmly believe this, and I want to leave you with this, that cutting the courts do not save the taxpayers in Minnesota any money. You're going to pick it up in other costs. You're going to pick it up in public health costs. You're going to pick it up with individuals that we can't direct to immediate treatment, which a lot of you realize is necessary in order to get them to get the help they need immediately. We're going to have increased victimization costs. And we're going to lose citizens who are not educated and who are going to be more of a burden on the taxpayers from the standpoint of future support. So I don't think cutting actually is a benefit in this particular system. And at this time, I would like to introduce Jim Rumsey. He's a Wabasha County Drug Court graduate. Jim has a compelling story to tell you. He was primarily involved in the sale and distribution of cocaine. He has a long history of alcohol, methamphetamine, and cocaine use. And he's also here with his father today, Bernie. Where are you, Bernie? And I do welcome his dad. His dad's a veteran. He has supported his son throughout this difficult time. And it does show the ripple effect that obviously an addicted individual has on not only families but our society. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jim. Thank you, Jim.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Rumsey. I apologize. I'm just new to me. So.
It's okay. Take your time.
What I have is I have recently graduated from Wabasha County Drug Court exactly a month from today. I've got a little over 19 months of sobriety. Just to read a little bit, I've had 5 DUIs. I've been incarcerated for drugs and alcohol 6 times. One of those was 4th-degree sales and distributing of cocaine. I've been locked in detox 4 times, lost my job in construction 4 times due to drugs and alcohol. I've been hospitalized twice for numerous car accidents. I've been caught up with the system for over 15 years. My family didn't know what was going to happen to me, and my friends didn't want nothing to do with me anymore. I had no respect for judges, police officers, any authority or figure at all. I didn't have respect for myself. All the times I've been in the drug courts, I had no hope for me. It seemed all the judges wanted to do was lock me up and throw away the key. Limited probation didn't work. It was very easy to manipulate the system. July 5th, 2007, I got introduced to drug court, and I'm very happy to say that my sobriety date, that is my sobriety date. I've been sober, like I said, over 19 months, and my life keeps getting better. Here I found a judge in the drug court panel, and the drug court panel that wants me to succeed. I've never seen this from any other judge or district attorneys. Never. It totally changed my views on the thoughts of the drug court system. To see somebody, it's a high-ranking figure to me because, you know, they always told me what to do and what I had to do, you know, and to see them want to help me, it was a total change. Drug courts made me responsible for my actions. They have a system I could not manipulate. The random UA test, 4 times a week. While in drug court, I got sober. I got my job back. I paid off all my creditors, every single one. I was 3 months behind on my rent, you know, going to be evicted. They helped me through that. I got caught up with that. Most of all, I had love in my heart to give back to my family and society. Drug court helped me build a foundation. But when I graduated, I could return to society an upstanding citizen again. I've lost my license for 3 years, and I've got 1 year to go. And thanks to my mother and father, they helped me considerably, driving me back and forth to and from work. As far as 150 miles one way, they dropped me off, but I had to get permission and do the right thing through the drug court and to be tested, which was great. To be supervised that well, I didn't want to cheat, manipulate the system. It gave me the opportunity to be honest, and that's what the big thing with drug court is be honest. I can never pay back my parents, but just being sober is a good start. I've been to high schools, speaking to kids about drugs and alcohol now. I sponsor people in a 12-step program for drugs and alcohol. I'm here to say that drug courts do work. It has worked for me and others like me. I've seen people get their GEDs. I've seen people get their kids back just because of this drug court program. I've met a wonderful person. He's my best friend. I used to use drugs and alcohol with him. I've seen him at a sober fest that we put on. the first Oktoberfest, and I couldn't believe the difference I seen in him. And I asked him to become my sponsor, because if he could do it, I got a good chance of doing it. A very good chance, because the way he was, I just amazed, you know. So just from seeing him being sober, I have a wonderful life today, and I owe it to the judge and the Drug Court Committee of Wabasha County Substance Abuse Program. And also, even after graduation, we're planning hunting trips and fishing trips and doing responsible things during and with participants of drug courts in our county, so that they can attend and be sober living too. Thank you very much for your time. Drug courts is a solution in my book, and I'll pass for that.
Thank you, Mr. Remsey, for sharing your story and for all your progress. Judge, you said that you were talking about some California statistics where 75% of individuals who come into the court system remain arrest-free. Do you have some data, and Mr. Sal, I know we've asked this in the past, how many individuals are not going to prison because they have gone to one of our 37 drug courts in the state of Minnesota?
What we've doing currently, Mr. Chairman, is the state is doing updated recidivism studies, and we can certainly get that information to you.
Do you have an estimate?
I would have to believe it's probably very similar to what the national statistics are.
Which is?
I would think probably a third at least, and I don't have the accurate number, but I would think you'd have that many. See, the difficulty, Mr. Chairman, we have 2,200 drug courts nationally now, and one of the what we're trying to do is expand that on a national basis as well as at the state level to provide more individuals into the drug court system. And by doing that, we feel there'd be a collateral cost savings as a result of that. And that's our goal, is to provide more people into those courts. As you know, we, as the courts, refer more people into treatment than any other agency, us not being an agency, but as far as any other entity in the criminal justice system. So it's important that they get before us, that we can make a determination that there are low-risk offenders, if you will, from the standpoint of non-violent offenders that have high-risk needs, meaning that they have chronic and serious addiction issues.
Mr. Dahl, do you have the number?
Mr. Chair, we are just still cranking out what we have.
You have an estimated number?
I don't have an estimated number, but I can give that to
possible.
You. I hope that it's in the next few weeks. Are we getting this?
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Remsey, thank you for your testimony. I just want to have Mr. King come down for 1 minute from finance, because I want to ask you a question and get this on the record. Thank you, Mr. Remsey. I really appreciate it.
Members, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge, for your testimony. Mr. King, could you just introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and member, I'm Tim King from Minnesota Management and Budget.
Mr. King, the question is that when Mr. Saul gets us this number about how many people like Mr. Rumsey perhaps are not going to prison because of intervention through the drug courts in our state, would we as a committee be able to bank those savings relative to incarceration rates, bed savings at the Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chairman, the current way we're forecasting that impact is basically offset the folks coming through the court system. And my understanding is the recidivism issues go out like about 2 years, and we should basically, if there is in fact an impact of the drug courts, that should already be being worked into the forecast that we're using for prison bed impact. As far as future impact, we would generally consider this to be something we call a secondary impact. We acknowledge there may be secondary impacts, but it's not something we would normally count in a forecast.
So are you saying, if I understand that correctly, that the Department of Corrections should have already factored in the bed impact based on the success of the drug courts in their biennial budget request as well as their bed their bed capacity numbers.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I'm saying exactly that. I'm saying if it's already being reflected in the court, in the folks coming to the court system, if there's already some impact in the people that are being sentenced to corrections, it would be included in that. If it hasn't shown up in that yet, it would not be.
Okay, I'm totally confused, but maybe we can, I think we need an answer to this, because I mean, we're investing a lot of money, and I think the committee supports existing drug courts and expansion of drug courts if we can, but, you know, we want to know that the resources we're putting in here are then being realized over here in the Department of Corrections, and I can't seem to, maybe it's just me that's not able to understand this, but I think we're going to need some help from the Department of Corrections and have this discussion as we move forward. But thank you, Mr. King.
Thank you.
Mr. Saul, we have a couple questions of, it might have been for Judge Rencourt, I'm not sure, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment. I have had the pleasure and honor of visiting our drug court in Brainerd several times, and I would encourage members, Mr. Rumsey, congratulations. And that is a common story and life-changing pattern that you see within the drug court system. So, members, if you get an opportunity, because you know we're looking and we're making tough decisions, and you know we always talk about good investments from like education or whatever. But this is really a wonderful investment that changes people's lives, and I've just had the pleasure and opportunity to be there, 10 to a dozen times, and very impressed every time. So thank you for your work and comments.
Thank you, Mr. Ward, Mr. Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question here, and I don't know which one of you wants to answer this. You made reference to trying to fund. When you said funding, were you just referring to the presently existing ones, or were you anticipating expanding it? Because all these white areas in the state of Minnesota, a lot of it's in my area, and I'm not overly... I love the drug courts. And I've been a former prosecutor for 32 years. So. But I'm a little concerned if we're just expanding it where it is and we're not doing something with the parts of the state that we aren't hitting the whole problem.
Yes, sir.
The budget is for existing drug courts, not for expansion at this point in time. The DCI made that decision based upon the current budget crisis, quite frankly, to do it that way. But I agree with you, Mr. Member. It's extremely important to try to expand this. And getting back to you, Mr. Chair, on the issue of the numbers of cost savings, there are some states that actually, I think it's California, and I don't have the exact numbers, Mr. Chair,
Missouri
as well, but I'll attempt to do is to provide you our office those specific numbers personally, because they have a formula where they've actually provided money for drug courts based upon cost savings to corrections or prison savings. Is a formula, but I don't know exactly how they've done it specifically, and I don't want to put that on the record at this point in time. But the best way to find those numbers out, I think, would be through corrections, because in order to place someone in drug court on a departure from prison, you'd have a dispositional departure. You would have to find out that they're amenable to probation, meaning they're amenable to a drug court. So those numbers should be available through corrections, I would think, and I'll try to find those specific numbers for you as well, right?
Okay.
On a statewide basis.
We appreciate that and would like that information. Representative Haas, and then we should move on.
Thank you. Just a couple comments, maybe a question. One of the things that's very interesting, when people get out of drug court, they actually graduate from drug court. I mean, there's a celebration. People clap, and they have parties and balloons, and, you know, it's a joyous occasion. That's not happening when people get out of prison. I mean, it's a completely different situation. Stearns County was one of the initial leaders, as you know, in drug court. But I would like, my question would be, when we separate people of those that are going to drug court and those that are not going to drug court, what type of criteria are you doing that on? Are you doing it on safety? Are you doing it on potential for success? Or what are you looking at in that separation?
You're not looking at public safety issues, you're looking at...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Sorry. Representative, what we do is we do an analysis to determine what type of individual should be in the drug court to start with, and that's by using certain testing and criteria to determine if they are high-risk offenders. By that I mean chronic or addicted individuals, not so much high-risk public safety risks. We do not allow violent offenders in the drug court. That just doesn't happen. Violent offenders, in my opinion, belong behind bars. So there is a criteria, and there's also evidence and research out there to say you do not mix high-risk and low-risk offenders in the same group, because the low-risk offenders could then become high-risk offenders. So there's a criteria to do that. You know, the other thing is the GAO, there was a 2005 report from the Government Accountability Office that clearly indicated for every dollar invested in the drug court, there's a return of $3.31. By that I mean a correctional savings and other savings not counting public health and employment and taxpayers.
Thank you. Representative Cornish, then we'll move on.
Mr. Chair, and Your Honor,
thank you.
How do you balance out money and funding for drug court for what should be done anyway? In other words, we got POs, we got counselors, we got people in the system that are being paid anyway. How do you judge what drug court should get? The reason I'm asking is our department gets asked, the police department, to go out and make a random check on somebody. They're not reimbursed for that. Who else in the system is expected to do it as part of the regular job versus extra funding from drug court funding?
Judge Ed Court.
Mr. Chair and Member, I think that's an excellent question. What we attempt to do in our juvenile drug court, for example, in Chicago County, police officers do go and do knock and checks. That's a big part of our program and is helping make it successful. We have probation officers, public health, human services, mental health workers, county attorneys, public defenders at our staffing table. They are there as part of their jobs, and that's why they're, if you will, representative, part of our team, if you will, a funding team. They volunteer a lot of their time, but as part of our cost here, as far as grant costs for our partners, that's another thing we're taking a look at. And I think it's about $3.2 million now as part of our drug court budget at this time for partner costs. So they do, and I want to make sure I'm clear on this, because the normal probation officer still has a tremendous caseload outside of a drug court, because they're dealing with those non-high-risk offenders still. So that's still going to continue. So this is over and above that. And what we've seen, I think the research shows this very clearly, that one of the benefits of a drug court is constant appearances before a judge. And in a drug court, you'll have a four-phase program. In the first phase, they're in court every week before a judge. And so what will happen is we staff those cases on a weekly basis with the individuals I just talked about for the purposes of trying to figure out a way to have immediate sanctions and immediate rewards for that individual to get them on their way. And I've seen it personally with some of the kids that have come in. I've had young kids come in on my detention calendar with methamphetamine issues. Just a terrible, terrible condition. Graduated from the drug court, sent us a closing letter, which they always do, indicating that but for drug court, and these kids are dropping out of school, representative, these kids have no employment home. They graduated from school, they got GEDs, they're going on to secondary education. And one young lady specifically told me, and she was a methamphetamine user, that by graduating from drug court, she renewed her relationship with her parents and was able to walk down the street again with her head held high. Now, these are actual people. You know, we talk numbers here, as we have to, of course. But this is the human condition we're dealing with. And when you think about the number of people that come before our courts on a daily basis that have alcohol and other drug issues, it's about 80% of our cases. Child protection, divorces, bankruptcies, across the board. And we can't just put them in a corner. You just can't put them in a corner, because they're going to come out somewhere. They're going to come out of that box. So this has been a program that I was skeptical about at first. I'll be very honest with you. I was skeptical about it. And when I started doing it, I started seeing the benefits of it, and talking to the probation agents, of course, that they're seeing the benefits of it. and law enforcement who start seeing the benefits of prosecutors, public defenders, so that they do work. And I hope I answered your question, but...
I've been to the drug court and I'm familiar with it, and I have supported. I just want to make sure you're stretching your dollar and not paying people for something they should be doing already. So you answered my question.
Right. Thank
you for your testimony, Judge, and I thank you again, Mr. Rumsey, for your telling your story. Mr. Saw, we're running low on time here, so.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the last request. We wanted to have you have that understanding of what the drug courts are about and why they're so important. This is the request for sustaining the courts we have already. The Judicial Council has adopted the goal of drug courts throughout the state, and we began that process in earnest last biennium. And we had hoped to go further this year, but obviously with the economic situation, the deficit of the states, the most we could do is just try to hang on to the courts that we already have. So this is you remember that last year we asked for $7.4 million at conference committee. We got a chunk of that cut out. We ended up with about $4.1 million. We testified then that we had hoped that we would be able to get federal grants to close that gap, and we did through the Office of Justice Programs and Traffic Safety, as well as some federal grants. We ended up getting about $3.1 million to close that. So that's how we've been able to get from, you know, two courts to 37 actually. We need to sustain those. So this cost is to provide for the 24 months of operation in this next biennium. Some of those courts got started in 20 months and 18 months into the biennium, and to sustain those courts where we got federal grants, but they're expiring during the course of this next biennium. So the cost that we've asked for is $4.5 million.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I know we're short of time, but Ms. Lassell, I'm looking at the budget book, and it looks like the numbers are different.
Yes.
And then could you just real briefly tell us what do you mean by partner cost? What's in that?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling, the numbers in the budget book were about $8 million. In the last week or so, we have heard that the federal grants that we were able to secure in this current biennium that were set to expire have now been extended. So we were able to reduce by a significant amount our request, and so we're happy about that. In terms of the partner cost, that includes these costs for the extra time that the various justice partners have to spend on drug courts. So this is for probation, prosecution, public defense, as well as drug testing and some treatment costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, well, it's great that we're getting the federal money for this, but is that matching funds? I mean, is there a requirement that maintenance of effort or anything like that?
Some minimal matching.
You're talking about a current federal money. You're not talking about the stimulus money.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Please continue.
That's the end of our budget presentation, Mr. Chair. We had been asked to talk a little bit about what we're doing by way of efficiencies and so forth. I don't know if you have time for that, if you'd like us to make that presentation.
Can you go through that quickly?
I think we can. We'll have asked Jeff Shorber, the Deputy State Court Administrator, and Deb Daly to...
Just 1 second, Representative Ms. Bissell.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. And again, you can tell me if you want me to wait on this one, but I had some questions about the law library, and I didn't know if that's part of their budget, and so I was just, do you want me to wait until a later time, or do you want me to ask?
Let's see if we can't get through with some of their presenters here. Can we hold off on that?
Okay, but I did want to ask it on the record.
Okay. What was the question?
Well, I'm just looking at the budget information request, and the tax. There is a cut to the law library, but I'm wondering about, one, isn't there a library fee? And two, isn't a lot of the stuff done online? So I guess when we're hearing about the dramatic cuts to the personnel and the system of our courts, which I want to preserve for efficiency and for justice sake. I'm just wondering if that maybe isn't an area for innovation, or at least an area that you may want to take a look at more.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, I have Barb Golden, who is the Minnesota State Law Librarian, and she's here to answer those questions.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. I am State Law Librarian Barbara Golden, the 25th librarian, and we're celebrating 150 years of service to the territory and the state. We along with the court, are doing the same reductions and cost savings that we can do through 10 years of budget. Our budget has remained about the same, even though the cost of materials have risen each year over 15%. We do that by relying more and more on online materials and resources, and reducing the amount of print materials, although there's still a lot of print materials that need to be preserved and kept, because we have to preserve our legal history. Our staffing is down to 2.5 people. We're in a hiring freeze, so we're trying to make do with that. And some of our staff is also, we manage several services. We are the state law library. We take that function very seriously. We serve the entire state. Our motto is first rung on the ladder of justice, and we also take that seriously. So we serve groups of people that might not be served otherwise, such as the Law Library Service to Prison Program, which is funded by the Department of Corrections. We also advise and assist the county law libraries and provide services to the citizens through the county law library system, as well as providing an extensive website. 47% of our use of our reference services come from the general public, non-lawyers, non-government. The amount of hits on our website has increased 55% over last year. The amount of questions coming into our Ask a Librarian, which is an email question, has risen 15% over the last year. So the services are obviously needed in this economic time. We're getting more questions about mortgages, we're getting more questions about the basic problems that people have. And we start them on the process, and then they go on.
Representative Bingham.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. Isn't there a fee that either people that go through the system have to pay, or, I mean, I guess, where does that go? I'm assuming some of the times it's waived, but I'm just wondering.
I think you're thinking of the county law library funding,
okay,
which is done by filing fees. The state law library itself is funded completely.
I'm sorry.
Representative Bingham.
Of the $2 million, then, that goes for operations of your whole staff?
Yes.
Golden.
Yes, 40% of that is rent, because of the space that we have. Other than that, about 25% is collections, and then 34% is staff, and 2% is operations.
Okay.
Thank you for your testimony. You want to go through the rest of the presentation, please?
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Shorba. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator. I will try to keep this as brief as possible. Some of the points have already been covered this morning. Slide 27 just highlights the way we react to our efficiencies. And in your packet, you have a copy of the branch strategic plan. This current plan is for fiscal year 2005 to 2007. On the table of contents, you'll see that there are three broad goals for the plan. These are long-lasting goals that will continue into the next plan, which is currently under development, and will be approved before the beginning of the next fiscal year. I'm not going to go into the details of the plan, but I do want to point out just one example of some of the efficiencies. On page 6, you'll see the goal, access to justice, in the plan. Under each plan, there are initiatives. Under this particular goal, there are three initiatives. The first being completion of our transition to Mensis. You've already heard a little bit about that as we talked about our technology initiatives. Just some statistics, each day we send about 40,000 messages to law enforcement and criminal justice partners from NMSIS. We get about 20,000 inquiries every day into the 11 million records that we keep in NMSIS. All of those inquiries are free right now for our partners to come into NMSIS and use this web-based technology to get quick and easy access to these records. In addition, this has allowed us to move work around the system. As you've heard, we are instituting electronic case initiation, both from criminal justice law enforcement entities who are entering citations, as you heard a little bit about on Tuesday, as well as pilots that we are doing for criminal e-filing and the capacity to do civil e-filing in the future with NMSIS. In addition, under this initiative is also expanding resources for pro se litigants. As you heard a minute ago from Barb Golden, the number of individuals coming into our courthouses and asking for information who do not have attorneys is growing exponentially. So we began a pro se litigant project, a self-help center, using staff and attorneys in Hennepin County. We now provide resources across the state in every county where an individual can come up to a computer terminal, can get access to forms, questions answered online, as well as a telephone access to those attorneys in Hennepin. So we've been able to expand that resource across the state to help others who need help with legal issues or legal questions. It's also helping, hopefully, to reduce some of the burden on our staff because we have less of those staff at the counters to answer questions. Briefly, just talking about efficiency strategies, things that we've been able to do over the last 4 years as a result of state funding of the judicial branch. One has been to move resources and standardize practices across the state. We're able to use our staffing study, which projects staff need based on case growth, to better match resources where staffing demands. One of the ways we've been able to do that is by equalizing funding. Obviously, counties came into state funding with different kinds of resources, some better funded than others. We have tried, through the use of our staffing study and the data that we've collected, to move those resources across the state. Unfortunately, due to the current economic system situation, even though we are fairly equalized funding across the state, we're now all equally underfunded. So that's one of the issues that we're dealing with and why you've heard a lot on Tuesday about our staffing issues. We've also flattened the management structure. Before state funding, we had 87 counties with 87 court administrators. Now 40% of the counties, a court administrator oversees more than one county. In one situation, overseeing three counties, and we're shortly moving to one individual overseeing four counties. We've also flattened that management structure at the district level. The 7th and 8th judicial districts, as you heard on Tuesday, now operating with one district administrator, as well as the ability to reduce supervisory levels, both at the trial court, court of appeals, and at the Supreme Court level. And we've been able to move work around. NMSIS allows us to move work. If one district or county has an issue with a high spike in work or a busy trial, we're able to move work across to another county and sometimes across district lines because individuals can enter information into NMSIS wherever they are. They don't have to be in the particular location where it's necessary. Structured restructuring of state programs. You heard a little bit from Sue some of the changes that we've done in response to Representative Ward's question about the Guardian Ad Litem program. We're doing similar things in our jury, psych services, interpreter programs. In psych services, for example, we've now been able to set up a statewide database for vendors and individuals who are contractors to pay bills, statewide roster of those eligible, and a process for making sure that those are available to individuals statewide. We now have an RFP for statewide contracts where individuals will be on a set fee amount per case, hopefully to reduce the amount of cost for these psych services and to have those people serve across the state. And also using employees. We are using now employees, psychological psychiatrists and psychologists in Hennepin County to do some of these exams across the state in areas where it may be difficult to find individuals outstate Minnesota. So we're trying to use the same kind of efforts that we have done in the Guardian Ad Litem program to restructure these programs, reduce management costs, and also to provide more consistent practices. The other thing that is mentioned on this slide is our debt collection system. In 2006, we began using an outside vendor to collect costs, reducing the number of employees who are doing these kinds of things in the court system. Since beginning that program, we've referred $125 million of debt, some of it very old debt, difficult to recover, but we have recovered $20 million $13 million of which goes to the general fund. The rest goes to state agencies as well as local jurisdictions. Performance, I won't spend time on this slide. Jed Swenson on Tuesday talked about the Office of Legislative Auditor report and the comparison that we did with Metro judges' caseloads compared to those judges in Hennepin County. We've also had a lot of confidence and trust from both the business community and the public. A National Chamber of Commerce survey in 2007 showed that Minnesota courts ranked in the top 10 in terms of confidence and fairness. And a study we did ourselves statewide in 2006 showed that Minnesota courts have 80% of the confidence of the public in terms of being impartial and fair. In addition to these outside entities judging our behavior, we've also spent time establishing our own performance measures because we want to consistently determine whether our performance is meeting high levels of quality service and accountability for our use of public funds, and Deb Daly is going to briefly talk about that.
Ms. Daly, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Deb Daly, Manager of Research and Evaluation with the State Court Administration Office. I'm just going to touch on very briefly an effort that has taken place with the Judicial Council, who has one of their very first policies that they passed when they came into play in 2005 was to establish some core judicial branch goals and to figure out how to measure those goals. You see the goals in front of you, and what we did was we took a look at what had been done nationally. The National Center for State Courts has established some what they call core tools. There are 10 measures that they're suggesting that courts around the country start utilizing to help them understand their courts better. We have taken many of those core tools and implement them along with some others of our choice. And we now have a comprehensive collection of performance measures that we've put together. We are actually one of just a handful of states in the country that have done this in this comprehensive fashion. And we are very pleased to say that we have been able to now present to our Judicial Council a comprehensive report that contains all of these measures. This was presented to them in November of 2008. Mm-hmm. So we now have some results. What we have done is we've done some survey work. We've actually conducted surveys across the entire state of Minnesota in each and every courthouse. This was actually no small task. This was there was like 7,700 survey responses that we received across the state in over 100 locations with a response rate of 79%. Those responses were primarily positive, although we did have some areas that we need to look into in the courts, including things such as our public website and our business hours and being able to get work done in a timely manner. We also did a quality court workplace survey to take a look at how our employees and judges feel about the state of our judiciary at this point in time, and also got relatively positive results on that, but are looking into some of the problem areas as well. In addition, we have timeliness measures. As listed here, we do clearance rates, time to disposition, and age of pending. These are all measures that help us to determine how well we are doing. We look at this by case type. We can look at this by districts and by counties to see how we're doing in various places across the state. For the most part, again, we're doing relatively well. There are some areas where we do have some issues. Major civil cases, for one thing, are growing dramatically, and we are seeing our clearance rates aren't as high there, and we do have a growing pending caseload there. In the area of felonies, we do have problems with not getting those cases done as timely according to our standards. And our age of pending cases are growing in the juvenile area and in the minor criminal area as well as the major criminal area. We have the comprehensive report that I mentioned is available on the public website. We welcome you to go and take a look at that. It's very lengthy, it's very dense, but if you have any questions about it, you can contact us, and we can do certainly a lot more than what's in that report. It was meant to give our Judicial Council the first flavor of what it would be like to see all of these comprehensive measures and to start thinking about what this means for us as a branch. We are going to continue to review results on an ongoing basis and to engage districts in looking at their specific data, their county data, and to get folks to start working with this information as a way to help us to better understand how we're doing as a branch.
Thank you, Ms. Daly. Is there any questions? Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sherba. Mr. Saul, you want to come up and conclude? I think we're... You know, I just have one quick question. If we can go back to slide 3. Just trying to, just want to make, see if I understand this, the staffing impact slide. Are you, when you talk about a hiring freeze and holding open judge vacancies, are you talking about if the budget cuts are enacted, the 5% recommendation by the governor, or are you talking about, is this the status quo now?
That's status quo now.
Mr. Salvan, can you just answer why, you know, I have two articles here that we found just in the few days, in the last few days. There's an open judgeship in the 4th Judicial District that you're filling. The seat is opened after the death of a judge, and up in Judicial District is that the 6th. A trial court judge vacancy as a result of the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision to convert a vacant court referee position to a district court judgeship, assuming that's additional staff if we're creating a judge. So why are we creating judgeships in the middle of a budget crisis, or filling judge positions in the middle of a budget crisis?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. The hiring freeze, the delay freeze for judgeships, was decided by the Judicial Council in December, at its December meeting, and there some of these judgeships were in stream, and the governor had already made appointments to that. The particular had already interviewed and was about to make appointments to a couple of those. So we did fill a couple of them in Hennepin County. We have 4 that are open, including the one in St. Louis County, and the appointment was made, but it is indefinite as to when the person is going to take office. The decision is to hold off at least until the end of the biennium and see where we're at. So that position, by the way, has been open since last June. There's been no one in that position since last June.
Hennepin County?
No, I'm speaking of the one in St. Louis County. And in Hennepin County, there were 3 judgeships, two of which were filled because they were too far in the stream of where we were in the appointments. One, the death of Judge Pelagia, is being held open. There is some statutory timelines that we are complying with. For example, the Supreme Court must certify its position within 90 days. So we're waiting 90 days to do that. Then once we certify, then the Judicial Merit Selection Commission has to go through its process and has 60 days to do that, and it's going to do that. We've had conversations and an agreement with the governor's office, with the commission staff, that after that statutory time is done, that the governor will hold off on making those appointments. So we're having to comply with certain statutory requirements. So some of these vacancies are being announced. They're being announced because they have to by statute. But once they go through the process, our understanding is that those that are now coming through the stream, that they will not be making appointments or interviewing, as I understand the governor. So we're holding open those. We expect to have 6, maybe 7 positions that will be open by the end of the biennium. There are 4 right now.
Thank you. Are there any questions for you? I thank you, Mr. Saul, for your presentation. I need a motion to approve the minutes, February 24th.
Mr. Chair, I would like to go on.
Representative Haas makes a motion to approve the minutes of February 24th. Are there any questions or corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. We have 8 minutes left. I'm just wondering if legal aid wants to start, or if you would prefer we can adjourn now and start up on Tuesday.
Strongly both ways.
Would you prefer to start on? Okay, I think we'll do this because we have a caucus scheduled for 10 o'clock. This will give members time to get over to the floor. If there's no other sort of business before the committee, we are adjourned.